You're about to enjoy TryHards, courtesy of MTGCast.com. If you enjoy TryHards or anything else supplied by MTGCast, please make a donation. Whether it's recurring or one time, you can help offset the very real overhead of bringing you the best podcasts in magic every week. MTGCast at MTGCast.com.
I had to destroy Arena.
People look at you like you're crazy.
Final four finishes.
It feels like you're going back to old school Magic.
Greedy in Magic is my default setting.
Go with your passion week to week.
I think it's still a card or two away.
They have done a hell of a job capturing the essence.
It's got the 14-year-old in me really, really excited.
Oh, you brave soul. Welcome to this week's outing for the Tryhards. I'm Sean Seacrease, he's Matt Hurley, and he's Brian Tibbetts. We're going to get to a GP in Rainytown. We'll figure out why everyone was so eager to come out in one of the brewing homes of America. And we'll get to our impressions as Dominaria has gotten the red carpet treatment from Wizards. And we get it started each week with What Are You Drinking? Matt, get us started this week. What's in your glass?
You guys are going to make fun of me. I haven't had any carbs today, so I'm having a Bloody Mary, and it is delicious. And yes, I'm having a Bloody Mary at 9:45 at night.
I am not going to make fun of you because I've had your Bloody Marys, and they are very good.
So we found a mix that is actually very close to my Bloody Marys, and I don't have to make a gallon at a time. I can make one Bloody Mary, but there's about 12 or 14 grams of carbs in each Bloody Mary, so I literally have to limit to my low-carb days.
Okay, this is what always gets me, because when I go on vacation with Megan's family and things, and we sit down to play some cards late at night, usually it's euchre, I've got usually a Dark and Stormy or a gin and tonic, whatever, and people are making Bloody Marys at 9 at night, and I just kind of tilt my head. I can't do it. It's too much salt and tomato, and
I would knock me right out.
Wow. Why haven't I had your Bloody Mary? Why do you hate me so much, Hurley?
Well, you know, every time I seem to bring beer to the Tryhards gatherings, we drink 1/20th of what I bring.
That's fair. That's fair.
But I will.
I'm not going to say. No. We drank all of it in Pittsburgh. You and I went on the beer run, man.
Yeah, we did drink all that. But what? I will bring Bloody Mary stuff to our gathering that we have coming up. I can bring the mix with me.
That's going to be all kinds of trouble. We'll figure this out and see whether or not it's going to be able to happen.
He'll be the one with the tomato-stained outfit at the
time. Well, it's not a liquid. It's a powder. I can get the rest there.
Is this? Oh, okay.
Okay, I no longer want any of these. We'll have to figure out another way. That's what's Matt drinking. I'm actually going to make Matt happy on two fronts tonight, both his taste buds and his tight, tight wallet. Matt, the beer store that's not too far from me has a get-to-know-your-bullet display. They got a special, and it is full-on pints for $9 of bullet bourbon and bullet rye. So ooh. I picked some of those up, and we've got the straight bullet bourbon on ice here in the studio this evening. So I know that would make you happy slash jealous on both fronts, both frugal and delicious. Brian, what do you have in the night?
This is just all Hurley all the time. I had a beer that reminded me of him since he's our finance guru. I saw the 4-pack cans of Four Hands Cash Money Imperial IPA, which has got some sweet artwork on it. It's got like the fist coming at you with all the bling rings on the front kind of punching out at you. So Hurley, in honor of you, I'm drinking this 9% alcohol by volume. And I'm on number 2 already, so God knows what's going to happen by the end of the show, but this is all for you.
I'm going to have to count the number of times we hear from Brian's end of the mic and see how this show ends up. What magic did you guys play this week? Matt, I know you had some time.
I did. I got to play one wacky draft, which I'm like, it was fine. I drafted Iconic Masters, Origins, and KTK. Didn't really pull crap, drafted a Boros deck, and it was fun. Everyone had just wacky, like, weird packs. So that was just something fun to do on Sunday afternoon, hang out with some friends. Or, I'm sorry, Saturday afternoon, hang out with some friends. Friday night, I did get to play a little bit of Modern. I didn't get up to the shop in time to actually make the FNM, but I played through several matches with the blue-black Ashiok deck. And I got to say, it's doing a whole lot better than I thought it would. Still got some tweaks to make to it. I'm going to take it out officially to our F&M. Our modern F&Ms are just blown up. I think last Friday's was 43 players or something like that. And so I have this odd feeling I'm going to be playing another large F&M on Friday night. The testing's going well. I still have some changes to make, though. But I love the One of Sire Stagnation, too. Playing that out in modern, just people look at you like you're crazy.
Well, they're not too far from the truth on that one.
Right.
Your LGS was having a modern blow up, ours was having a standard weekend. Modern is coming up this weekend, and then it'll be pre-release for Dominaria. Played standard twice, once on Friday night in the F&M, and then on Saturday in the store championship. Friday, I tried to innovate a bug Heart of Kirin sort of aggro deck, and I learned a valuable lesson with that we'll talk about a little bit later and what we did to get better at Magic this week. That didn't go very well. For the store championship on Saturday, I got back to my roots, Grixis Control, and if I was going to go down, I was going to go down on my own terms. And I told Lori on the way there, I said, I have that feeling that this is going to be an extreme day. I'm either winning or going 0-2, and I'll be home in time for the third inning of the Cardinal game. I was home in time for the third inning of the Cardinal game. There were mulligans and land troubles and a 26 land control deck with cantrips. And it was not good, but it was always fun. And a lot of people came out that we don't see a lot at the LGS for the store championship. Crew came down from Iowa. Some guys came in from further away. So it was fun to play with a different group of players we usually only see for pre-release events. Brian, did you get to play any Magic this week?
No, I actually have a very sad story, gentlemen. I have been trying to play Arena as much as possible, and the side problem to this was I would show up at work the next day, and I would be trying to open certain programs on my work computer because that's the only one that runs Windows since we're kind of a Mac family here. Things were just kind of blowing up left and right. Well, I was kind of eking by until the other day when I finally had to call the tech guy in, who I have a special relationship with. And I said, hey, Glenn, is this because I have this installed on there? He's like, oh, gosh, absolutely. You got to get that off there. So I had to destroy Arena. I had to uninstall Arena on my computer. So not only do I never get to play paper Magic because my life is my life, I don't even get to play Arena anymore until I get my new computer, which I've already ordered. And you know what? I probably won't even play Arena because I'm so excited to load MTGO on that and just get some serious legacy testing and, you know, blow up the household budget. Who needs food and clothes for the children when Brian just wants to play Sneak and Show and Blue Red Delver on MGO?
It's actually a very thrifty choice of you because you could use the same mana base.
See, that's kind of what I'm thinking. It's all about efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. When the wife comes calling, guys, I'm going to just put you on speakerphone while I'm running out the house.
You better hope that you is Matt, because she's not going to listen to me. We played those cards out decades ago.
Decades. You're absolutely right. So no, I was bummed. A couple grinders around here went down to a couple tournaments. It was the very end of the qualifying season. No one else from our area RPTQ qualified, along with Eric Hoffman. So we'll see. Guys are a little nervous about who he's going to invite to the team event. So, you know, I'm out totally, because I'm like, no. If he invites me, I'm just going to say no. There's other people more deserving. Yeah, that's kind of the big thing going on right now. So I'm just kind of sitting back and watching, wondering who he's going to ask to go.
Guys, we're going to be soon announcing April's Patreon hangout. If you're a Heart of Famer or a Heart of the Hards, keep your eye on the Patreon page and your ears on the pre and post show for more on that right here on TryHards. And if you're not, well, consider it. You love the show. You want to jump in and spend some extra time with us? Really wasted time when it comes down to it. You can do that. We'll give you more details coming up on the Patreon page. If you want to spend more time with Matt, his stream comes up on Wednesday night. You can check it out on Twitch. Matt Hurley, TryHards 3, probably going to have Ashiok in Modern. So buckle up. There is a thanks that I want to throw out to one of our patrons, Renee V. I didn't clear this with her, so I'm not going to give out her full last name. She wrote an Urban Dictionary definition for Reef Donkey. Now, if you missed this is from last week's show.
She did not.
After Brian introduced us to what he was drinking while on vacation in Florida, and we said that Reef Donkey sounds like a whole bunch of other things. Urban Dictionary definition for Reef Donkey. Thank you, Renee V. It is an amberjack that swims around reefs or sunken boats off the coast of the Outer Banks. The jackass of the sea. Alternate definition, the hardest fighting fish this side of the Oregon Inlet. Alternate definition, someone who really you off at work. A hard-headed son of a reef donkey.
So I'm not, we can't read the quote at war or on the podcast, but the quote is pretty funny and it's very adult.
Oh, that's hilarious. That is hilarious.
Going out of her way. We appreciate the effort, Renee. And that brought a smile to my face when I saw that. Well, Reef Donkey, you've got the look at GP Seattle that was the Legacy side this weekend. Oh. Legacy got the full meal deal Friday and Saturday. It was great to see our favorite format on the big stage for Wizards.
1,663 players showed up to rainy Seattle to do battle in Magic's greatest format, Legacy. In the end, it was local boy Daniel Duterte taking down the Frenchman Jeremy Desani. Duterte was piloting Grixis Delver. Jeremy Desani was on the four-color control deck, the two decks that were featured throughout the entire tournament this weekend and were well represented in the top eight. Two Grixis Delver decks, and if you would tell me that both Grixis Delver decks in the top eight, one of which was piloted by Noah Walker, and he did not take down the tournament, I would be a little surprised, Sean. Were you very surprised that he lost in the quarterfinals?
You get to that point and anything can really happen. The accomplishment was getting there. Noah Walker, in my mind, still the preeminent Grixis Delver player in Legacy. The thing that continually blew my mind is when they would show the graphic for the makeup of the deck of Grixis Delver. That deck plays 18 lands and four of them are wasteland. It plays 14 colored mana sources, and I'm including fetch lands because you can go get whatever color you need. It plays 14 colored mana sources. Yes, it has all the cantrips that it can cheat in order to find those, and that is supported, bulk warded by the one mana planeswalker, Deathrite Shaman. But just to make sure, and I know it's made on the margins being able to operate on just two mana for the most part, but that would make me nervous. 14 colored producing lands in that deck that's trying to run 3.5 colors. It only has the green in it when you want the green side of Deathrite Shaman. That continually surprises me that they have room to squeeze in those four wastelands. Is it the best deck in Legacy? I think the question is, are the best Legacy players opting for that deck? And what I've now noticed continually is that the best Legacy players opt for either Grixis Delver or lands. And so I would think that once you put the best weapon in the hands of the best players, it's going to get a skewed representation as far as its day two metagame percentage and height of finish and so forth. But it's definitely the deck that you have to have on your mind in a, let's just say, 9-round tournament that you would play. You're probably going to face Grixis Delver more than once, lands probably once. So I would be much more worried about my Grixis Delver matchup than my lands matchup. But these two decks, to me, have really become the two boogeymen of the format.
The Grixis Delver decks having two in the top eight is basically what everybody kind of predicted would happen in this tournament. I don't know if anybody predicted that there would be two Miracles decks in the tournament, along with one four-color control, one Sultai control, which is really what Desani was playing, and then one Lands deck that was piloted by Sam Black. Hurley, did anything in the top eight stand out to you or surprise you?
I think what was surprising to me was the amount of Deathrite Shamans. It was only surprising to me because I don't think that should be the case. Are we headed for a ban here? Maybe? Question mark? What was there, 20? Was there 16 or 20 Deathrite Shamans in the top eight?
Well, 16 would be fine. I would think that would be half the decks playing Deathrite Shaman. And when you have something that has a hybrid mana color, a lot of decks are going to be drawn to that because it gives you both control and offense and mana fixing. Now, the question you brought up is, are we headed for a ban? I think Legacy is the home of things that may be OP, but people just like playing with them. I feel like if you're going to have to ban Deathrite Shaman, then you're going to have to ban Brainstorm.
I don't think that is. I think it's more so that Deathrite Shaman allows you to do these ridiculous mana bases. I just have to look at it and I have to think, okay, look, is this where we're headed? What are we doing here? I think it would make a better format if they got rid of Deathrite. Don't really see a problem with it, but no, it was great to watch some Legacy at a high level. From what I understand, the whole tournament was just an absolutely ridiculous, fantastic tournament to be a part of, and that there was all kinds of cosplaying, there was all kinds of side events going on. There was just kind of the first GP Vegas all over again.
Matt, I'm going to take umbrage with something you said, and that's that Deathrite Shaman is the bigger offender. If you have Deathrite Shaman without the cantrips to continue your forward momentum, you get one use out of a land that's in the graveyard, or you get to exile one lightning bolt or fatal push. You need those cantrips in order to ensure forward momentum for your Deathrite Shaman. I think Deathrite Shaman without Brainstorm is less of an offensive format than Brainstorm without Deathrite Shaman.
Maybe, but regardless, I think Deathrite Shaman just makes mana bases too good. If it was a 1-1, we'd be having a completely different conversation right now.
Oh, sure. If it only had 7 abilities instead of 11, yeah, we wouldn't be having this conversation at this point, Brian.
This is why people just need to be playing more Pyroclasm and more Board Sweepers. And I don't understand why that's not become a thing that has happened, because if you look at all of the decks that made the top 8, low the top 16, it's just filled with so many small creatures. And I kept thinking to myself, and part of this I think was influenced by watching Andrea Mengucci stream this crazy monastery mentor build, and he had like 3 Pyroclasms main deck, because when you cast it on Monastery Mentor, the prowess triggers. And so therefore you can't kill Monastery Mentor. By God, it does such a good job of taking out opposing Baleful Strixes and Deathrite Shaman, 2 cards that were running rampant over every game, it seemed like, that Wizards was streaming this weekend, Sean.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head. If I'm looking for a sweeper in Legacy, it's Pyroclasm. 1, it's 2 mana, so it trades either efficiently on par or ahead of most of the things that it kills. And 2 is its solo mana requirement for 1 red and 1 generic. If we look at the things it trades with, flipped or unflipped Delver, Deathrite Shaman, Young Pyromancer, all the Young Pyromancer tokens. You mentioned it before, Baleful Strix, everything that Death and Taxes plays. So to me, this is the sweeper of choice in my mind, if you want to go that way in Legacy. You look at all the other tokens it picks up your Rogue Dark Confidants. I think if you're going to go with a sweeper, Pyroclasm is the one that fits the demands of the format in both mana efficiency and being able to deploy it in a timely manner while playing a second spell in that turn.
I was a bit surprised to see how many Marsh Casualties were in people's sideboards, and I totally understand why. And I think that probably was the right choice for this tournament to take care of kind of the one butts. But I was just wondering how many times people wanted to play Marsh Casualties kicked. And because the mana restrictions on some of these very, very lean 4-color control decks, very, very lean Grixis Delver decks, you couldn't play that kick to get the, you know, -2/-2. You only had to do the -1/-1. Is it as effective of a card? No, I don't think it is. I don't think it is. And that's why my mind immediately goes to Pyroclasm.
I think you're probably, you guys are probably right. I would probably look at -1/-1s, you know, like the Marsh Casualties, just because of all the True Name Nemesis. There wasn't a ton running around, but there was a decent amount if you look all the way down. I guess we're talking about a format here that's really not that supported by Wizards. It is, you know, it is still a major format for Wizards, and they do have large GPs for it, and they have record shows, you know, like turnouts for those GPs as well.
In my mind, the only other competing sweeper is Toxic Deluge, and that's because, again, it's 1 mana, 1 black, 2, and then you can scale it with your life as a resource to whatever you want to kill on the board. Now you're talking about a true sweeper against a Grixis Delver, because you can pay 5 life and get Gurmag Angler. You can get some of the bigger threats, provided they haven't hit you with it, you know, 2 or 3 times already. But playing it on curve and 3 mana doesn't seem like a lot, but in Legacy, you need those efficient answers. But you can pay a little bit more if you're going for a board sweeper. So in my mind, Pyroclasm is option 1 if it's available to you. And then a little further back is option 2, Toxic Deluge.
The rest of the tournament played out a little bit differently than what I thought it would. 9 through 16, gentlemen, featured only one other Grixis Delver list, a lands list, an infect list, Matt Nass on Tin Fins, finishing 12th, and that was an absolute ball to watch on camera if you hadn't seen. 1 Turbo Depths list, which had kind of cropped up here and there throughout the tournament, and then something that I did want to talk to you both about, 3 other copies of the 4-color control list. So if you pair that with the 4-color control that made the top 8 and the Sultai list of Dasani that made the top 8, that is 5 of those 4-color control lists represented in the top 16. We've gotten to a point, gentlemen, where Baleful Strix, Leovold Emissary of Trest, and Liliana the Last Hope has supplanted kind of the blue and the red creatures of yore. Is this where Magic is heading? more of this four-color kind of mashup of the best creatures, and we'll worry about the mana base later? And did you ever think that maybe Liliana of the Veil would be the second fiddle Liliana Planeswalker in Legacy, Sean?
Well, Reed Duke made this point over the weekend, and that is that Legacy right now is being pushed to a format of hyper-efficiency. You look at a card like Baleful Strix. It's two mana out of a deck that plays either three or four colors. It replaces itself, and as a blocker, it can kill anything without indestructible. And that covers most of the decks in the format. It also, if you're playing Tarmogoyf, instantly gives you the harder-to-get type of artifact in your deck. So as we look at how decks are built right now, I think toward hyper-efficiency, you're looking at a card like Baleful Strix that's suddenly a defining card in the format.
Hurley, I totally agree with Sean, and that's the card that seemed to, every time I turned on coverage this weekend, I would step away for 5 minutes, and I'd turn it back on, and somebody else was casting a Baleful Strix, and somebody else was casting a Baleful Strix, and it just kind of seemed to me that there was just this wave of blue, black, and green decks that were just kind of overwhelming the format, and oh, by the way, they would fetch up a Badlands just to catch Kolaghan's Command at some point. Is this surprising to you? Were we on to something last January when we headed to Louisville with our Leovold decks? Is just this the next iteration of this, or is this something that maybe is going to get supplanted by Miracles at some point in the future?
I don't think it's going to get supplanted by Miracles, but I do think that Miracles is a decent counter for it, and that in the sense that it's one of the decks that can grind just as much as those decks. Those decks are strange because they can both be greedy on the mana base, protect their mana base, and grind. And that's really where you get these huge monstrosities. You know, as Magic as a game ages, you give us better mana bases, and they're going to, this is what's going to happen. So I think it's just something that we have to pay attention to. And I'm hoping that, you know, something will foil us as far as these greedy mana bases. Who knows? Maybe Blood Sun is a good one, but even these mana bases are running Blood Moon. So, I mean, who knows what you can do with it?
I don't know if Blood Sun is going to be the thing, but I do have to give props to both of you in your own regards. Matt, you were on board with Strix before anybody else I knew. You kind of saw this train coming, and you love playing it as a value card before the format had widely adopted it as a whole. And Brian, you mentioned Miracles. You really are the one who taught me about the power of Back to Basics. Has it surprised you that in the wake of Top being banned, so they can't rely on the Top lock anymore along with Counterbalance, Miracles has moved to, as a standard it seems, two copies of Back to Basics in their deck as a way to get ahead of the greedy mana bases?
It's funny, when you think about it, it makes such total sense. Most people splashed red in the Miracles builds from, you know, years past for Blood Moon primarily to kind of take care of those problematic matchups. And we already had an answer all the time, Back to Basics, so you didn't have to go to a third color. And I think that's what makes the Miracles decks of now maybe climbing to be on par with those of the Top decks of the past. It can never surpass it. Top was just too good of a card. But that's why you have two decks in the top eight, one of which was running the Monastery Mentor build, and the other one which was just trying to beat down with Entreat the Angels. So that just kind of shows you that the shell is very, very effective no matter what your finisher is going to be. But I think Back to Basics is kind of like everybody should be hitting themselves on the head saying, no duh, that was the easiest play to make many, many moons ago. But with this current slide toward the four color and the Grixis, where you have very greedy mana bases, especially with Wasteland in your deck, Back to Basics is only going to do better and better work going forward, I think.
Yeah, it's one of the cards we'll be keeping our eye on in Legacy going forward. It was a double GP this weekend in Seattle. Not only Legacy on center stage, but Standard as well. 1,500 players for Standard. There were 11 undefeated players after day one. Three of them, Jeremy Fry, Andrew Sheehan, made it to the top eight after starting undefeated in day one. I left out one name. That was simply because he took it down and made history going 18-0 at a GP. First time that's been done by playing every round. Ganyan on Mono Red defeated Grayson Roberts 2-1 in the finals. Blue Red God Pharaoh's Gift, though, Matt, was the breakout deck of the weekend. That was the runner-up Roberts deck. Blue Red God Pharaoh's Gift. This is supplanted White Blue God Pharaoh's Gift. It had three decks in the top eight. It was the most represented archetype in the top eight, five in the top 16. Matt, you were on God Pharaoh's Gift before many people were in the format. What do you think about this red-blue iteration that moves even further into the realm of combo and away from value like we saw in the white-blue iteration?
I have a stack of cards around here somewhere. I mean, I don't know exactly where they are. I'm going to tell you it's about 2 inches tall and it's nothing but combat celebrants. So that should tell you what I think of that card. I think as the combo portion of it with those combat celebrants, oh my gosh, that card is good, good, good. Standard, I think we've said this before, Standard's just in a super weird place right now where, to be frank, I just don't enjoy playing Standard right now, and I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's that the decks all play out the same. I don't know if it's slow or, you know, if it's too fast. I don't know. I just know I don't enjoy playing Standard at this current juncture. I do look forward to Dominaria Standard, but this God Pharaoh's Gift, I think, is kind of a unique spin into a newer Standard format that a lot of people are kind of in the same boat as me, where they're not really enjoying it that much.
With this version of Standard seemingly DOA, now with the arrival of Dominaria just days away, I think there's a bigger question that I want to dive into for just a moment, guys, after watching this player finish not only in the top eight, but in the final four. We just had the NCAA tournament. I think we need to bring this to Magic. Yes, we have top eight finishes, but final four finishes. And that's Jerry T. He was known as a guy who crushed the Star City circuit, but struggled at pro tours for years. And struggling at a pro tour is no hit to your resume. But he's broken through, has a pro tour championship to his name, along with multiple great finishes. Now is seemingly turning up at GPs and spiking top eights almost at will. Is it time in your mind to put Jerry T among the very best in the world?
That's a really, really good question. I think he might need one more signature win for him to be up there in kind of the all-time greats. But just because he did have a little bit of hiccups along the way, that's nothing against Jerry T. He's seen as somebody who's at the top of his game no matter where he's showing up in, you know, with whatever deck he's got. I think he's right there on the cusp. And I will say this, I think it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. If he continues on this current trajectory of him playing as much as he currently is, there's no question in my mind that he will be in that conversation and will be in the Pro Tour Hall of Fame with a couple more signature wins.
I think he's amazing. I think he deserves everything that he gets as far as, you know, how hard he has worked, what he's done for the game. I mean, he's been a big proponent of the game. He always seems to be able to put a good spin on the game and talk about even stuff outside the game. And I think everything that he does is great for it. And so I think he's going to quickly be, you know, one of the all-time greats, you know, top 10, top 20 players, however you want to put it. He's getting up there very, very quickly.
I do believe he said that he's going to be at GP Hartford this coming weekend. That's going to be Modern. The other GP coming up is in Sydney. That's Team Unified Modern, as they'll be playing that one in Australia. Well, from the GP in Seattle to the SCG Open in Milwaukee, things have started hot there for the Brewer baseball team, and things were hot on the Modern Open front. It was the largest SCG Open in history, their largest constructed event. I actually had the honor, along with some other buddies, of being at their largest event ever. That was a sealed gold rush in Charlotte many years ago. They were doing the gold rush. That tells you how long ago that was. Matt, this one was interesting from the get-go. I'll let you finish adjusting your owl suit as we get started.
Modern is very popular. We had your day two metagame, just to kind of knock some out. Eight humans, eight burn, six hexproof, green-white hexproof, which is boggles. Five Ponza, five Affinity, four Jeskai Control, four Mardu Pyromancer, four Hollow Ones, and then it kind of goes down from there. A lot of players, up-and-coming players, did very well in this. There was a very wide array of different decks that you had to go up against. Green-Red Eldrazi ended up taking it down. Vincenzo Bilisteri, we had in the top eight. Green Red Eldrazi, Burn, Affinity, Jeskai Control, Humans, Blue Moon, Scapeshift, and Eldrazi Tron. And I thought that that was just a really good kind of mix of everything. I did get to watch some of it. We had an Ironworks combo that snuck into 23rd. Didn't look like a lot of the Boggles players converted. There was one at 20th with Todd Stevens. As Sean mentioned, Jeff Hoogland played Owling Mine, dressed up as an owl, but I think he took 923rd place, so he actually only won one match. Yeah, I mean, everyone was having fun. It was a great pairing for GP Seattle for people who could not go out to that.
You know what deck intrigued me the most? I think it's still a card or two away, but that Blue Moon deck, to me, it's right there on the cusp, and it plays one of my favorite cards of all time, Keranos, God of Storms. That card is just so much value, and it gives you another angle to attack on. Brian, this deck to me is really the spiritual successor of the Tarmogoyf Rug combo deck where, okay, I can play small ball and nickel and dime you, or I can go all in with the combo and counterspell check you and win on the spot. This deck, in my mind, is the one that has the most play to go either way, even though I still think it's a card or two, maybe three away from being dominant.
The Blue Moon deck is really, really strong. Like you said, the different axes of the combo versus the nickel and dime, really, really strong, really, really good. You can kind of get your control mage on and then just combo out of nowhere. You've got Kiki Jiki Mirror Breaker going. That seems like a really, really good deck going forward that's probably going to take a lot of reps to really get the sense of what you're supposed to be doing down. The question I have is, what are the cards that we need in this deck? Because I'm looking at the list and it's hard for me to know exactly what to cut because it is kind of tight right now. And what would we need to make this a tier one deck to fight what's been the boogeyman at the top of the format with maybe some of the company decks, maybe the Hexproof decks, Mardu Pyromancer decks, and of course the Tron decks.
Obviously, efficient interaction is where blue and red wants to be. But if you could get some sort of passive damage going, the first thing that comes to my mind is something like Sulfuric Vortex, where you can start an absolute clock and then play a tempo game off of that. Sulfuric Vortex not available in Modern. But if you got something along that line, you would then be able to dictate the pace of play, use your blue to sort of play your Protect the Queen tempo game. I don't think Fevered Visions is the card that you want to be on at that point because it doesn't do quite enough for what it gives both players. But if we had something like I mentioned, like Sulfuric Vortex, I think that would go a long way.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I love Fevered Visions. That card has been kind of near and dear to my heart for a long time. But something, you're right, a passive damage type card, something that you just kind of have to hit the board and somebody has to deal with while you're doing your own thing. The one little change that I thought was interesting in this Modern Open that I saw made to the Mardu Pyromancer list was there was someone who was running Hazoret the Fervent in there. And is Hazoret something that we want to see in Modern? And boy, when I'm thinking about this, you know, somebody like Caleb Durward did not run this in his list. But when you're looking at some of the other people who are running just a one of, that seems like a really strong card, especially as often as you're emptying your hand in Mardu Pyromancer. Hurley, is that something that you would advocate for, or is that just kind of like you're winning more?
I don't think you're winning more, but I do think that there it has a place. This is where Modern gets strange, because I think it has a place in certain metagames, and you have to watch the metagames, and going to a big tournament like this, I mean, I'd call it borderline impossible to guess what the metagame is going to be. I do think Hazoret maybe can get a kind of like a one of in some of these decks, or maybe a two of, but I do think it's an extremely powerful card, and I think it's something that you shouldn't really overlook.
It was a lot of fun to watch that this weekend, and I have to say, tip of the hat again, one of my favorite broadcasts to watch during the Magic year is when a new set is starting to be unveiled, and the broadcast team for Star City Games runs the designs past Patrick Sullivan in the booth during downtime.
So good. I'd tune in just to watch that.
Getting really his thoughts, it. Getting the way he phrases things and communicates his thoughts, endlessly entertaining to me. And he's a guy that I really enjoy on this coverage and the life that he brings to the game that we love. Modern Classic followed up as well this weekend. 192 players. Mark Ballard on Eldrazitron, 2-0'd William Drescher on Living End. In the top eight, Brian, there were three Tron variants, two humans, and a Boros burn deck. I was pretty impressed with the burn deck this weekend, and it's had me double-checking to make sure that I still own the appropriate red cards Is your heart split in twain as a Burn player who also has a standing Eldrazi list in Modern?
Yeah, it is. But that's kind of the beauty of Modern is, you know, go with your passion week to week, play what you want here, there, and everywhere as long as you feel comfortable with the deck. I love the Burn deck in Modern because the games are quick. I mean, there's thought involved in the deck, but you kind of have an idea of what you want to do. Put the gas on the pedal and just keep pushing down. The great thing about the Burn deck is you're always making your opponent make decisions. Does he have it? Does he have that one mana spell? Is he going to be able to burn me out before I can get my combo rolling? Is he going to be able to burn me out before I can draw into another company? Things of that nature. I love that about the deck and the way you play the Burn deck. And I thought part of the great thing about both the Classic and in the Open, seeing the players do that, how they were playing the deck was pretty quick, pretty confident. I think that's a big part of those Burn decks.
Also in Milwaukee this weekend, the Legacy Classic, 128 players, Kyle Cosmell on Elves, too old Philip Bayer on Dark Maverick. The top eight, diverse as you would imagine for Legacy. But Matt, I did notice in eighth place, a deck that I'm liking in Legacy more and more. Now, one difference from this Legacy Classic to the GP we saw in Seattle, there were no fast combo decks that hit the top eight. But we saw Omnitel hit the top eight at the Classic at SCG Milwaukee. Omnitel is a deck that I'm liking more and more when I see the angles that it takes to the common hate in the format. Is there a deck that you're seeing after this weekend in Legacy that you're liking as the metagame sort of develops around Grixis Delver?
After this weekend, no, but I think it's going to change up. And I'm not just talking about Damping Sphere here, but I think the metagame's going to change up after Dominaria release. I do think there's some cards in there that are going to change the way some things play out within Dominaria or within Legacy. I would say I'm going to hold my how I judge that mono white stompy list, the mono white soldiers stompy list. I do think that looks kind of cool, and I do think that plays fairly well against the Grixis decks as well.
This Omnitel list is a little bit too all in on the Omniscience package for me. I still like the Sneak and Show with the two Omniscience that can still be brought in via Sneak and Show, but I still like having the Sneak Attack in to get the Grizzlebrand into play, to get the Emrakul into play. If you're just all in on one, I feel like that's just too much for your opponent to be able to identify early on. The other thing I'm not 100% sure of in this Omnitel list by Eric Schwamberger is the four Cunning Wish. It's not that I don't like the card, and obviously if you're going to go with the four Omniscience in the package, you want to have the Cunning Wish to go get what you need, but I think I still like the Burning Wish package to go get the other things out of the board that you want in the Sneak and Show package. So maybe that's just the playstyle thing, and maybe he's onto something. Maybe this is kind of the way to go around some of the hate.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that kind of the original tech with the Show and Tell decks before, I believe it was before Grizzlebrand was printed?
The one Show and Tell on the board, and then to do the Burning Wish. So if people surgicaled the Show and Tells, you could always Burning Wish for the fourth Show and Tell. The one thing I really like about this list is the Boseiju, and the Boseiju is seeing a lot of different play, and I think that's kind of the answer to the Grixis Delver and a lot of the permission that's running around in the blue decks nowadays is, if you're able to resolve either an Intuition or a Show and Tell off of Boseiju that cannot be countered, I think that's major game against the current metagame.
The old days when the best thing Show and Tell had to put into play was Jin-Gitaxis Core Augur. Creatures have come a long way, even from just a couple of years
ago.
Look
it up, kids. Look it up.
It was an orgy of magic this weekend in both Seattle and Milwaukee. We hope you got your fill, and we hope you saw some of the sweet try-hard playmats that were at play in Milwaukee. We're still looking for pictures from that, try-hards, if you were up there this weekend. Send them to us. Post them on the Patreon page. We'd love to see what you got up to. Guys, this week was the red carpet rollout for Dominaria. Wizards got down and into it on the mothership. They've been handing out preview cards. But with Wizards now going full steam ahead into Dominaria, we looked at individual cards that we liked last week. Matt, what's your sense of Dominaria, the return to where it all started, from the rollout to the story to the cards to your level of anticipation for the pre-release as this is now upon us in just days.
Oh, I am super excited. I'm excited because they have done a hell of a job of capturing the essence, the feeling of original Dominaria through the sagas, through, you know, you might call them the spiritual successors of these different cards that we played with. Are these going to impact standard modern legacy? I think so, but I don't know for sure. But I will say I am super excited to be able to play in this pre-release. I think it's going to be a blast. If you've been a longtime listener, you remember I made the mistake when I first moved down to Louisville of doing the midnight pre-release. I was up till, I don't know, 10 a.m., I think. That was not fun. They announced that for this one, they're going to limit it to 4 rounds. So you do 4 rounds at midnight, and then realistically, you can go back for the at a different store for a 1 o'clock pre-release, then a 5 o'clock pre-release, and then a two-headed giant the next day. I'm excited to do as many pre-releases as I possibly can. It feels like you're going back to old school Magic at this point.
Brian, is your excitement level high enough that you're not going to nap through your pre-release this time?
It's funny you bring that up because this I signed on for kind of a work thing that always tends to happen right around this time. And I checked the calendar a couple of months ago, and sure enough, I have to be gone Friday and Saturday of pre-release weekend, which has given me no end of heartburn because this is one of those pre-releases that I am absolutely just gaga excited for. To just open a sealed pool and see what I can build with it. So I'm unfortunately going to have to miss it. However, I've already kind of scratched out any other happenings on the calendar for release weekend. So I'm just going to have to get my draft game on and see how well I can do. But this set has got me really, really excited. I feel like we're getting such an injection of energy into the Magic game. From everything that's legendary, I feel like those who play EDH on a regular level are going to have so many different options to either add to their decks that they currently own or to brew new decks with. I feel like in the next 3 to 4 months, we're going to see this influx of EDH commanders that we never would have thought of before and different approaches to that. I feel like the saga cards are going to create some interesting timing issues throughout the course of the game as people play them and then wait for things to happen because of it. And I feel like just the power level of Dominaria is bringing us to a level, losing the energy out of Aether Revolt and Kaladesh. It's going to be back to kind of the basics of flying, first strike, trample. There's not a whole lot of new mechanics, right? There's nothing that's we have to kind of bend our mind to learning. It's old school Magic, and Hurley said, very, very much right in our wheelhouses. It's got the 14-year-old in me really, really excited to play this kind of format.
I can't wait to give my craw worm banding. That's how you know you're playing Magic. That's what we're looking forward to. I hope your Dominaria pre-release is great. We'll talk a little bit more about that coming up next week here on Try Hard. So that brings us up to this week's In the Elevator. Everybody, quickly, look on the back of your neck. See what your casting cost is. Maybe ask your parents if you don't know what it is, because you're about to get some extra mana with this week's In the Elevator, Matt.
This week's card is Nykthos, Shrine to Nyx. There's a lot of really color-heavy creatures within Dominaria, and this Nykthos is currently about $7. This is not something that's going to shoot up. It's been creeping up for a while. There's going to be a legitimate demand for these cards within different formats, including Modern and EDH. There's a lot of really good 3 casting cost cards within Dominaria. Could even spike to over $10, $15. So Nykthos, Shrine to Nyx.
Maybe Mono Green Stompy and Modern might need it. Nykthos.
I have played that.
Shrine to Nyx. This week's In the Elevator here on Tryhards. That brings us up to this week's 3 minutes to brew. Brian's going to warp our minds. What do you got?
This is such a good card. I know I'm kind of going green, but bear with me. This one looks really good. I've been impressed by the sagas. Not the same level of excitement on every one of them, but this one kind of caught my attention just because it's only 1 green and 1 other. Song of Freyalise. For 1 and 2 in the saga modes, and I'm sure you're all familiar with that, until your next turn, creatures you control gain tap. Add 1 mana of any color. So that's until your next turn, mind you, on modes 1 and 2. And on mode 3, after which you must sacrifice this, Put up 1/1 counter on each creature you control. Those creatures gain vigilance, trample, and indestructible until end of turn. I don't see how anybody who plays an elves or kind of a green-white tokens, a green tokens, green stompy, anything, can't imagine this being part of their build. Do you think the timing issues on Song of Free Elise is going to hinder it or help it as we move into new Dominaria? Sean, I'm going to start with you.
I think the fact that this costs 2 mana is an important part of it, and not because you want it to come down on turn 2. It's because later in the game, you can play it while deploying creatures so that you get the most effect out of the making all your creatures into Llanowar Elf. And we can make that reference again, because now everybody knows what Llanowar Elf does. It also gives you a go-wide elven army strategy that gets paid off on Chapter 3. If you're looking to Alpha Strike, those are the three qualities that you want. Vigilance, so that you're immune from the Counter-Strike. Trample, so that you get in maximum damage. And Indestructible, so you don't lose any of your team, and they're there to defend you if there's a Counter-Strike on the next round. I think this card is priced aggressively where the go-wide decks want it, because it can be good early to help you ramp out and then throw it away if you don't use the attack mode, and it's absolutely fantastic late. I think this is a card that is going to be very dangerous. Not dangerous as in broken, but as in dangerous to see it on the other side of the table.
I can't decide what to make of this card. I think at 2-drop, I think Sean's right. We're like, it's an easy way to ramp out. But at the same time, we don't have any kind of like 3-drop planeswalkers or 3-drop things that kind of crap out tokens continuously. We do in, if you go white and then you go with the other kind of the other sagas, this could suffer from the same thing that heavy mana rampers have suffered in the past, where you have all this mana, but you have nothing to do with it. If we find a really good mana sink, or this may cause the 2-drop Nissa, that blue green and X Nissa, to kind of pop up, because you know she can create some value, let you filter through your deck, and then you can get to those big cards you need after ramping, and then all of a sudden at the end, vigilance, trample, indestructible. So I just don't know if we have the legitimate mana sink, but I really, really like this.
What I really like about this card is it's just what Sean said, the 1 green and 1. It gives you so much flexibility to try to play it early and get some early pressure in, get some early points of damage in. If you've got that style of deck, it may be a green red kind of a hasty creature, pump your team and get in for as much as you can deck, versus, you know, it can hit the game in the mid and kind of take out your opponent's board, or in the late and just close things out. What I'm a little bit leery of in cards like the Antiquities War and the Mirari Conjecture with the sagas in blue, they're high casting costs. They're meant to be played later game. I'm not really seeing it. I'm not really seeing it as something that is going to have quite the effect. History of Benalia, that's cranking out night token creatures, and then night tokens perhaps get 2-1 in the same turn. Song of Free Elise can give you 1-1 and all the other effects. That seems to me like a game-ending card. So I think the timing of this is going to play into those people who are going to put the time in to test and see if they can get their sagas to kind of all resolve at the right time to where their team is going to go. There's a lot of legends in this set that give your team 1-1, that make them indestructible, that have all kinds of benefits for your creatures, which is what old Magic was about. And I think this is kind of one of those perfect synergies, and I think this card has nothing but a high ceiling to it.
3 minutes to brew this week. Song of Free Elise. Guys, there's one answer that old Magic didn't have. Settle the Wreckage. This just
gets
wrecked.
That card is a house against this song.
By that card.
For sure.
We'll see if Settle the Wreckage ends up playing the foil to Song of Free Elise. Guys, what'd you do to get better at Magic this week? For me, I learned a very important lesson by trying to play a bug aggro Heart of Kirin deck on Friday night at FNM. And that's that you don't have to be all the colors all the time. Greedy in Magic is my default setting. And it's a wonder that I don't play Grixis Delver in Legacy, because, as I said, Greedy is my default setting. I didn't need to jam the blue in there. I should have just gone with the green-black. I think there's something there. Is it better than Mardu Vehicles? Is Mardu Vehicles going to survive rotation? No. could this deck, the way I was playing it, yeah, I was trying to experiment with stuff going forward, playing almost entirely a post-rotation, other than Heart of Kieran, obviously, list to see what might be there. Don't have to be all the colors all the time. That's what I was reminded of this week as I got better at Magic, I hope. Matt, what'd you do to get better at Magic?
The big thing is I've kind of stepped back. I've taken a new position in my same company, but I've taken a new position. I've been a whole lot busier, so I haven't been able to focus on Magic nearly as much as I have been in the past. And I got to say, it's got me really excited for Dominaria coming up because I'm like, oh, I'm going to be able to focus a little bit more. But at the same time, I can appreciate when I play Magic now. I've had to skip the last two Wednesday streams. I'm hoping I don't have to do that again this week, hoping that my workload is a little bit better and that I can actually do it. But it really has made me appreciate the Magic I do get to play. And I'm finding I'm much more excited to actually go play Magic now than I have been in the past.
Ryan, what'd you do to get better at Magic?
Two things, really. First thing was I spent some money, and that's not hard for Magic players to do, but this was on a computer, namely a laptop that I can use to load up Arena again, but also to get in on MGO, because I think I've just decided, guys, that there's no way I'm going to get that much better at this game unless I get the reps in with certain decks that I like. Hurley, you've shown me the light, and that might be the only time you ever hear that in your life. But from that Mana Traders service that you use to kind of just, you know, hey, I'm going to borrow these cards from online vendors and get this stuff and crank out some reps with this. I think that's just the phenomenal way and to get better at Magic and to just try different things, get good reps in with decks. And I think that's kind of where I'm all in on making myself a better Magic player. The second thing I did was I tried to be very vigilant when I was watching coverage this weekend on the Legacy Open from Seattle and really see how people were playing their decks. I'm familiar with most all of the Legacy decks that were on camera, and I was interested in the decision-making process and how deliberate people were with their ponders, how deliberate people were with their brainstorms when they were casting their fatal pushes, things of that nature. And it really did cause me to look and say, huh, they're playing at a much slower pace than I think of good Magic players playing. And it really got me thinking of good Magic players play deliberately and they make good decisions. It's not about the speed to which they play. If anybody has ever seen Shota on camera, he's very, very fast and he's very skilled. He's in the Hall of Fame, for God's sakes. But that doesn't mean that's the only way to do it. So take your time. Play the way you need to play, make the decisions, and be confident in the decisions that you make. And I think that's one thing I took away from the GP coverage this weekend.
Oh, you brave soul. Joining us for another episode of TryHards. We'll see you again next week as we get ready to return to Dominaria on TryHards.